This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Facebook, escucha. Estamos en la lucha.
We deserve a severance package. The same severance package the Facebook engineers, programmers, code writers received.
I'm here to look for justice because we've been treated different than other workers.
Laid-off Facebook food service workers in Menlo Park demand equality and severance pay.
As we show in the report, those who tend to benefit would be large farms, agribusinesses who are really using this land to accumulate more land. They are not feeding Ukraine or they are not feeding Europe. They all turn towards export markets to the rest of the world to export and make money.
The Oakland Institute's policy director, Frederick Masseau, discussed a report on the takeover of Ukraine's agricultural land by U.S. capitalists.
Well, I think the county in this region, not just Prince William County, but this region, such as Loudoun County, have realized now what they get when they give a contract to a company like Keolis. They're in it for the money. For the bottom line is the money. And we are trying our best to work with some of the politicians here in the county and the state to get them to realize that these employees should be taken care of. And because Keolis wants to shortchange them and not pay them a decent wage, this is the situation we're in now.
A strike by a local of the Amalgamated Transit Union in suburban Washington's Loudoun County is now in its eighth week with pressure building. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook has terminated thousands of workers. Facebook food service workers who are members of Unite HERE, however, have not received just compensation compared to engineers and other laid-off workers. Over 100 have been laid off in Silicon Valley. They are rallying around the country and rallied at the Facebook headquarters in Menlo Park in Silicon Valley on March the 1st.
We're out here because January 6th, Flagship decided to lay off over 100 of our brothers and sisters. Right? How does that make you feel?
Angry.
So, we asked Flagship to come to the table, meet with us. We deserve a severance package. The same severance package the Facebook engineers, programmers, code writers received. Right? Don't we deserve equal treatment?
Yes. Yeah.
Don't we deserve to be treated like any other worker that works at this company?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, as a result, they've been ignoring us. So now what we're doing, we're coming out here, making noise until they sit at the table and respect us like workers we are.
And y'all better sit
Are you guys with me? Sit se puede?
We deserve it, we work for it, and we are part of the workability that makes it happen for them. these people need what they need because we're coming up. And I'm right here to get with them and help them get their money that they deserve.
We have received some type of compensation. We would just like to have more. Ideally as comparable towards what the engineers have received.
And how long have you worked for Facebook?
I've worked for about 6 to 7 years.
6 to 7 years. Why aren't they giving it to you? I understand they're giving it to the engineers, other workers that they're laying off are getting compensation.
Personally, I don't know.
Do you like working at Facebook?
I do. I like working with this company, or I like working with this team. As you can see, that we all come together for exactly the same thing, and it's really hard to find a group of people that would work together to get what they want.
So what do you have to say to Mark Zuckerberg?
If you see what's happening in Menlo Park, understand that, like, we're not looking for a free getaway for more money. We're just looking for, like everybody else, assistance to go through California.
My name is Marisol Mora. I'm here to look for justice because we've been treated different than other workers, and we wonder why we are different than the other ones. And we have the same needs or more. The economy is impacting us also. So you just want justice. We want to find out why we've been treated different than other workers.
How long have you worked at Facebook?
Almost 5 years.
5 years. Yes. Do you like working here?
I like it. I really like it. I started working as a DMO, the dishwasher, and then I look for to be a prep, and then I was looking to be a cooker. And I really enjoy. I see myself working over here for more years. I didn't expect that this. It could happen to me, and it could happen to anybody. The only thing is we're looking for justice.
And also the expenses, cost of living in Silicon Valley, very high. How do you live? How do you survive?
If I go to the market and buy one tomato, the same tomato that the Meta workers buy, it's the same one that I'm going to have to pay.
How long are you going to continue this fight?
As long as we can win. We need to win this one. It's fair.
Facebook, escucha. Estamos en la lucha.
Those were Facebook food service workers protesting in Menlo Park, California, demanding severance pay. Mark Zuckerberg is worth over $62 billion.
It's not the waking, it's the rising. It is the grounding of a foot uncompromising. It's not for gold. It's the heat that drives the light, it's the fire it ignites. It's not the waking, it's the rising. It's not the song, it is the singing.
That was Hozier, Mavis Staples, Nina Cried Power. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. U.S. officials call the Ukraine war a fight for democracy. The federal government has already spent $113 billion in weapons for the war, handing a major windfall to the military-industrial complex. It's less well known that U.S. capitalists are privatizing Ukrainian farmlands, which are some of the most fertile in the world. The Oakland Institute's policy director, Frederick Masseau, is the co-author of a study on these privatization efforts titled Theft, the Takeover of Ukraine's Agricultural Land. I interviewed him about this land grab. So, Frederick, why don't you talk about this document? Why did the Oakland Institute, decide to write this document?
Well, we've been following the land and agriculture situation in Ukraine since 2014, since the Maidan Revolution. And we started to work on that because, as as early as 2014, we saw international financial institutions, primarily the IMF and the World Bank, putting pressure on Ukraine to create a land market, so to put their agricultural land for sale. So there's been a lot of Western financial aid coming to the country, but the condition was for the country to privatize its land and to put it for sale for most of its arable land, 33 million hectares, which are thought to be the most fertile land in the world. So we looked into that, saying, okay, why are these institutions putting so much pressure on Ukraine, and who is going to benefit from this pressure? And we had three reports on that so far. The last one that we just released last week is the fruit of several months of research, where we were able to actually find out who is behind the agribusinesses, large landholders in the country, some information we didn't have before, which allowed us to identify a number of interests that were not known before around the land holding in the country.
And the policy of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, they believe in privatization on a global level. And is this, were they, I guess they were quite happy with the 2014 revolution that took place.
Of course, it was very clear from the start. The first aid package of the IMF World Bank, which was about $20 billion in 2014, was really tied to a structural adjustment program. So there was the privatization of land and creating a land market for agricultural land, but there was also a whole train of reforms for energy subsidies, for the pension system, the banking system. So it's the typical structural adjustment that we've seen all over the world that was, again, at play here, with a big difference, which was a specific context of Ukraine, and also this big land bank that these bankers were looking at, with this huge amount of fertile land that was up for grab. And this is, unfortunately, what has been happening since.
And the land had been nationalized. What did that mean as far as the operation of the land prior to 2014?
So actually, before being nationalized, it was privatized. At the end of the Soviet Union, all the land was public. It was either used as a state land, or it was with collective farms. And then at the collapse of the Soviet Union, the same institutions we are talking about pushed the country to privatize its land and rush into privatization of all the economy. And after a few years, what the government saw was that this privatization was actually resulting in this new class of oligarchs who had been taking advantage of this privatization wave to take over resources and accumulate huge amounts of land for their own benefit. So they were suddenly these gigantic groups holding 400, 500,000 hectares of agricultural land. And that was what the government decided to stop back in 2001, after 10 years of privatization. And they decided to put a moratorium on the sale of land to stop this process of accumulation by oligarchs. And since 2001, there was a lot of pressure to lift this moratorium. And this pressure really grew when Ukraine made the choice of the West in 2014, with now the whole Western financial assistance that was conditioned to lifting this moratorium. And since 2014 up to 2020, for 6 years, the IMF, the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development were all very strongly advocating and pushing the government, twisting the government's arm, actually, to lift this moratorium. And this happened finally under President Zelensky in March 2020. It happened against the majority of the population. 70% of the people were against this measure. But there had been very, very, very strong protests in the street in 2019, 2020 against the measure. But in 2020, there was COVID, and farmers and civil society could not protest anymore because there was this stay-home order in Ukraine. and the law was finally passed under Zelensky in March 23.
And so you're saying that as a result of the COVID pandemic, the government was able to push through privatization of the land?
Yeah, it was done despite all this very strong opposition by the population, a big opposition among the parliamentarians. They were fist fighting in the parliament at the time of the law was passed in March 2020. But finally, they went through and it was officially in place in July 2021. And now we have seen 1.5 years of this new land market in place operating now in Ukraine.
And the AFL-CIO, Solidarity Center, the National Endowment for Democracy, USAID, were they involved in this privatization drive in Ukraine?
The U.S. has been a very strong advocate. The U.S., we listeners have to know that the U.S. is really the government leading the World Bank because they are the main donor and they're the main force behind the World Bank. But we've seen also direct meetings between U.S. government officials, sometimes with U.S. corporations coming with them to the meetings to advocate for this law and this plan of reform. So the U.S. was very strongly in favor of this reform and has been very pushing very adamantly for it to happen.
Well, the government in the United States have argued that the privatization will mean that land is more efficiently developed. Is that the case? Is this privatization made it more efficient for the agriculture areas?
So that's a very good question. What is the point? And unfortunately, with our team of researchers, we've looked into hundreds of pages of official documents from these different institutions. And the key argument, the only economic argument that is put forward explicitly by the World Bank is that with this new law, the less productive farmers will exit agriculture, and then there will be some more consolidation of land into more effective, more productive farms. And the key argument is that this consolidation of land, moving out small farmers out of business, will create between 1% and 2% of additional economic growth. So that's the only really firm rationale that has been put forward. Clearly, it doesn't mean that the farms will be more efficient. It should be that there will be, it is expected to be economic growth. It will be hard to measure today with all what we know. But it doesn't mean that it's going to benefit farmers. It doesn't mean that it's going to benefit the food security or the rural development in the country or the well-being of farmers. Because as we show in the report, those who tend to benefit will be large farms, agribusinesses who are really using this land to accumulate more land. And these large agribusinesses who have under their control millions of hectares of land, they are not feeding Ukraine or they are not feeding Europe. They all turn towards export markets to the rest of the world. And it's really big ag business money that is at play there with number of interests who are going to be growing more and more on more land to export and make money.
And agribusiness corporations in the United States are major corporations. How did they get involved and how was this privatization of the land financed by Western capitalists, Western governments?
Well, what we see very clearly is between the World Bank agencies and the European agencies, like European Development Bank, which is a public European agency, there's been nearly $2 billion of financing of agriculture in recent years. And it's all of it going to these large agribusinesses, nothing going to farmers. We found $5 million going to farmers and $2 billion going to large agribusinesses. So this is a kind of contrast and difference of treatment we have. So it's going into these large firms who control large surfaces of land. And these large firms are a mix of oligarchs and foreign companies. And so we find one US private equity fund, we find another US company, which are the fourth and fifth largest landholder. But we find also, and it's very interesting, and this is something that was not known before, we hear a lot about the oligarchs, but actually we found that most of the oligarchs have kept some control over their companies, but they have also gone public on stock exchanges. And now we have all the traditional Wall Street investors invested in this agribusinesses. So we find large banks, investment funds, we find funds like Vanguard, like Copernic, like very, very big ones who are invested in several of these agribusinesses. And the only one that is not European or North American is the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia, which is also one of the largest landholder in the country.
That was Oakland Institute's policy director, Frederick Masseau. The Institute's report titled Theft, the Takeover of Ukraine's Agricultural Land is available on the website oaklandinstitute.org. That was John Lennon, Imagine. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. A strike by the Amalgamated Transit Union Local in suburban Washington's Loudoun County, Virginia, is now in its eighth week, with pressure building. 3 weeks ago, a Teamster local representing drivers for Prince William County OmniRide, commuter and intra-county service, called out its members against the same transit operator in Keolis, North America. Thomas O'Rourke of Pacifica Station WPFW spoke to Teamster strikers and union officials at their picket line in Woodbridge, Virginia.
Want it.
Right now.
When do we want it?
Right now.
When do we want it?
Right now.
Who are we?
Teamsters.
Who are we?
Teamsters.
Who are we?
Teamsters.
Who are we?
Teamsters.
What do we want?
Contract.
What do we want?
Contract.
No contract.
No work.
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 While some 150 members of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 689 continue a now eight-week strike against Loudoun County, Virginia's transit contractor, Keolis North America, another Northern Virginia county, Prince William, also contracting with Keolis, is beginning its fourth week of a strike by Teamster Local 639 with a similar number of drivers. Though represented by different unions, the drivers, maintenance, and dispatch workers in the suburban counties of Washington, D.C. face similar challenges from a hard-edged company determined to keep wages and benefits well below comparable drivers in the area while deploying multiple lies, ploys, and stratagems to undermine the unions and their members. I visited the Teamster picket at the OmniRide facility last Friday and spoke to 639 local president John Gibson, as well as a number of strikers. President Gibson, speak a little bit, if you can, about this company, this Keolis. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of the French National Railroad.
I know about this contractor, Tom, is we call it the race to the bottom. These contractors, the county puts out a bid for essentially the lowest bidder, and they bid way too low to afford to pay these folks a decent living wage and benefits that they deserve. And they are skilled drivers. They drive up and down these roads, the most heavily populated area in the country, and they do it safely. And with that should come some recognition in the way of pay. and good benefits and good working conditions. And this company has a history, and they've proven it time and time again, that they're not willing to take care of their employees like they should. So that's why we have a union here. That's why they call the Teamsters, because we are used to dealing with them. We have them out in the Midwest, and we've had these same issues with them before, where they come in and build a contract low, and then they can't afford to pay our members, their employees, a decent living wage.
This is Keolis you're referring to.
This is Keolis, yeah.
But it's obviously could be any company,
could
per se.
Could be any contractor. But yeah. The old saying, Tom, is you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
And when a contractor comes in and bids so low, how much are they going to do for the employees?
Does it help to have a relationship with, you know, the county management to say, hey, you know, you've got some bidders. You know, as a union, we've been around here for a long time, and we've seen contractors come and go. You award this contract, there could be some labor issues that will come back and haunt you.
Well, I think the county in this region, not just Prince William County, but this region, such as Loudoun County, have realized now what they get when they give a contract to a company like Keolis. They're in it for the money. For the bottom line is the money. And we are trying our best to work with some of the politicians here in the county and the state to get them to realize that these employees should be taken care of. And because Keolis wants to shortchange them and not pay them a decent wage, this is the situation we're in now.
Is it a long-term goal of Teamsters with these basically employees of a contractor providing a governmental service to eventually turn these employees into government employees? In other words, unionized but directly hired by Loudoun County, Prince William County, Anivia. In other words, to combat the move to privatization that's been the bane of unions for the last four decades at least.
Yeah, and Tom, that's totally up to the county. You know, they hire these contractors so they don't have to deal with those types of things like
right.
insurance. And but, you know, again, with the contractor, I say you get what you pay for. And what this company has done is, what the county has done is allowed this company to come in and bid the contract so low that this is the situation we're in now. Now you're not getting good quality employees because they're not paying them enough to drive like these folks do safely up and down the road. They're just not paying them enough.
What's the standard procedure if there's an accident, pray tell? I mean, you know, maybe no one injured, but an accident on the road.
Accidents happen, Tom,
yeah.
And that's why they call them accidents. We didn't deliberately go out and intend to have an accident on a given day, but we will deal with that appropriately. And we have things in this contract, such as progressive discipline, or if the member is proven not at fault, it could be someone else running into the bus. But we see that all the time here in this region. You've got heavily populated roads, you've got 95 corridor here, and you see accidents every day. But this is a skilled, professional group of drivers that has a history of driving safely, and they want to be paid accordingly. They want to be paid for their profession, for their professionalism. It's not always the driver's fault either.
Sure.
You know, they've got a 10-ton bus going down the road, and it's a lot harder to stop that than it is a Kia, okay? But these folks, a Kia or...
I drive a Kia.
Oh, you drive a Kia. Okay, so you know the difference between stopping the bus and your Kia.
Yes.
But nevertheless, they are professional drivers. We have very minimal accidents, and we take a lot of pride in their safe driving records here at Keolis.
Last question. How many passengers on a, you know, given day or during the week?
57 passengers 57. In a bus, and then the local buses probably will take 27.
Okay, times how many buses?
Times 100, and we have almost 120 buses plus.
Okay, so that's what, 8,000 or so?
So you've got a lot of daily people, commuters running around this county, Prince William County, that are delivered to their destination safely every day because of these drivers. And it's time the company wakes up and realizes that the success of this company is because of these drivers. And again, they should pay them accordingly.
Is there been any, in Loudoun, the commuter rails or the commuter service seems to be running sporadically, but getting people to the metro. There are numerous metro stops in Prince William County, are there not?
We have Springfield, which is the Franconia
yes.
Station.
Blue Line.
The Silver Line in Tysons also. These connect through Maryland and then DC and Virginia. Now that we are not, you know, running these connected buses, people are having a hard time going to work.
Leslie, 23 years here, 20 years with this company. We're hoping that the pressure that the public puts on Keolis and PRTC to get its drivers back to work, that they are considering the time that the public is being inconvenienced. No doubt there are families that are falling short and their obligations to their places of employment because the bus company may be the only mode of transportation for them.
Yeah.
So those are the people that we have in mind when we're staying out here to get just a reasonable contract for our members.
Those were Teamster strikers and union officials of the Amalgamated Transit Union in Loudoun County, Virginia, speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke.
Like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window. That was Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, The Message. Libraries and what residents of Manatee County in Florida get to read there was on the agenda of a workshop Tuesday in the Manatee County Government Administrative Building in downtown Bradenton. The Republican-only Manatee County commissioners discussed how to rein in what they believe is bias in public libraries after listening to a presentation by the manager of the Manatee Public Library System, Tammy Parrott. Simon Valick reports for Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida.
What started out as a discussion about how the library system can modernize and increase its outreach into the less literate communities quickly turned into a question of bias in the library system. Commissioner James Thatcher brought up complaints from his constituents that there seemed to be more left-leaning books in libraries than right-leaning books. Tammy Parrott, the Manatee County Library Manager, said that it is difficult to figure out the political leanings of a book.
If there is a book and we either want to categorize it as a Western, a romance, an adventure, a thriller, it can be all of those things. So in the same way, a book could can't necessarily be labeled correctly either a left-leaning book or a right-leaning book. I mean, some of them maybe, yes, but most of them no. So it's hard to have any kind of binary list of left books, right books.
Currently, there are no statistics about the proportion of left-leaning books to right-leaning books, and it would be hard to find statistics on that due to the fact that most books are not clearly politicized one way or the other. In the workshop last week, Manatee County commissioners began to discuss what books Manatee County residents should get to read. At that meeting, Commissioner Vanessa Baugh suggested Manatee County libraries were too lax in filtering their books. The county commission's lawyer cautioned that what commissioners should do is, quote, make sure that what you're offering in your libraries covers all points of view, not just one particular point of view. The lawyer also warned that, quote, it is a tough issue for a board of elected officials to deal with directly, book by book. He added that an advisory committee to vet books would be legally defensible. During last week's meeting, Commissioner Amanda Ballard said that in her search through the Black History Month selection that was being promoted on the county library's website, She saw the 1619 Project and a biography of Angela Davis, an American Marxist, but not books about conservative African Americans like Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. Ballard said that, quote, "The books that are being pushed in this collection seem to have a certain bend." Lee Washington, acting county administrator, clarified that this Black History Month selection was not created by the library itself, but rather by one of its third-party vendors. When the commissioners tried to come up with ways to have the same number of left-leaning books and right-leaning books, Commissioner Jason Bearden discussed an idea on how to lower the cost of buying more right-leaning books.
Is there a way for us to cut costs by cutting some of the books that we currently have, maybe selling those books to a different library, maybe up in New York or somewhere in California, and then maybe leveling it up where there's 100 books on this side and 100 books on this side?
Parrott responded that the books that are currently in circulation in the library system do not have a high resale value. However, she did add that she would try to include more subject reviews of new books and existing books into the library budget. Last October, the Palmetto Library, which was being used as an early voting site, had a bit of a controversy when it had the LGBTQ display in the front hall. The display was a timeline of the LGBTQ movement throughout the decades. It was not made by the library, but by a third-party citizen group, ALSO Youth. Commissioner Ballard stated that her qualm with the display was not that it was LGBTQ, but rather that it was overtly political. With the library being used as a polling station, it was inappropriate to have it there. The display was quickly taken down, but the commissioners want to make sure that instances like this would not happen again, with Commissioner Satcher calling for an updated library display policy. The displays that go into the libraries now have to be approved by several people, including Acting County Administrator Washington. LGBTQ books and books on sexuality in general were also under questioning. Commissioner Ballard suggested a system to expand parental consent for children to check out books.
For some of those young adult books, I did say that we need to, you know, expand the parental consent. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. I have the thought of, you know, a separate consent for young adult books, coming-of-age books.
Ballard said that, quote, "It would give parents a little more confidence, especially in those young adult books." Commissioner Baugh suggested that books concerning all sexuality, straight or LGBTQ, be put in one section of the library, and that kids should not be allowed in that section. Since libraries use the Dewey Decimal System, most all books concerning sexuality are already grouped together, and they are already in the adult section of the library. No decision for policy change has been reached at this time, but commissioners have agreed to have multiple workshops in the future to further discuss the Manatee Library System. This has been Simon Valick, reporting for WSLR.
The U.S. has refused to restore Ethiopia's preferential trade status unless it submits to an international investigation of human rights violations during the Ethiopian Civil War, which ended in December 2022. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
On January 1, 2022, the U.S. canceled Ethiopia's tariff-free access to the U.S. market because of alleged human rights violations during the Ethiopian Civil War. At the outset of the war, in November 2020, Ethiopia had the fastest growing economy on the African continent, and the U.S. trade preference had been stimulating its industrial base and generating foreign exchange. Suspension of the trade preference cost 5,000 Ethiopians their jobs. The war ended in December when federal forces defeated the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a longtime U.S. proxy, but the U.S. is refusing to restore Ethiopia's trade preference unless it agrees to cooperate with a U.N. investigation of war crimes, which could lead to international prosecutions. Ethiopia has established its own process for investigating and prosecuting war crimes and moved to have the U.N. investigation terminated. International war crimes tribunals typically affirm the foreign policy objectives of the U.S. and its Western allies. While the U.S. uses tariff-free access to the U.S. market as a carrot and stick to impose its will on Ethiopia, China has stepped up to offer the country tariff-free access to its own, much larger market. Chinese global television network host Zhang Shi spoke with Ethiopian finance minister Ahmed Shiri.
China will grant zero tariff treatment to 98% of taxable items originating from Ethiopia starting March 1st. How important is that for Ethiopia, and what are your expectations when that kicks off?
First of all, we would like to commend to the leadership of China under President Xi Jinping for offering this zero tariff treatment for Ethiopia's taxable export items and also other countries. This shows very timely and a proper decision from the People's Republic of China to advance our cooperation. This will also facilitate export of Ethiopia to China, which is very, very important. And the investment we made in the past, the fundamental objective was to enhance our production capacity. And this new decision is fully welcomed by our Prime Minister and the government. And the companies, Ethiopian companies and international companies who are in Ethiopia will benefit from this. And as a result of this, the production capacity in Ethiopia will be enhanced. And particularly at this period, where there is multiple challenges of COVID, international price increase due to conflict in Ukraine, climate-related problems we have of drought, this will support Ethiopia's growth and development. And the solidarity the People's Republic of China has shown for this period is very useful, and we are very thankful of this.
That was Ethiopian Finance Minister Ahmed Shidi speaking with CGTN host Zhang Shi. China is Ethiopia's largest trading partner, source of investment, and project contractor. It is the country's partner in construction of the railroad between its capital, Addis Ababa, and Djibouti's ports on the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean at the interface of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Was the great Wayne Shorter, Speak No Evil, Mr. Show. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. A series of events in a number of Latin American countries have left observers scratching their head as they try to determine the actual political orientation of the government in each case. Don DeBar spoke with journalist Stephen Sefton about recent developments in a number of countries with supposedly leftist governments that are appearing to stand with the U.S. on some issues but not others.
Contradictions among the leaders of Latin American countries, mixed signals in dealing with the U.S. by Brazil and Colombia and Chile, among others. For more on that, we go to the beach in Nicaragua at Pochomil and speak with our reporter from south of the border, Stephen Sefton. Stephen, welcome. Let's talk about contradictions.
Yeah, and there have been signs of the kinds of contradictions that one might expect, especially on the part of the more social democrat-aligned political leaders in Latin America. For example, Lula da Silva has been very critical of what he calls Russia's invasion of Ukraine, thereby conveniently forgetting the 8 years of war by the Ukrainian government in Kiev against its Russian-speaking population in eastern Ukraine, which in finally Russia felt bound to intervene to defend them. So Lula conveniently forgot all that crucial history. But over the last couple of days, there have been a couple of Iranian warships that have been on duty patrolling in the Atlantic as part of Iran's policy of projecting its naval military presence beyond the Persian Gulf. And so these two warships requested permission to dock in the port of the Brazilian capital, Rio de Janeiro. Sorry, Brasilia is the capital, but the main city in Brazil is Rio de Janeiro. And so these two Iranian ships requested permission to dock in the port. The United States tried to put pressure on the Brazilian authorities not to allow them to do so. And Brazil finally gave permission to the ships to dock in Rio de Janeiro. And that's just an example of the kind of the toing and froing between assertions of independence and sovereignty on the part of these governments and expressions of submission to US foreign policy. And we can see that also on the part of, in particular, for example, of Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia. And he has now, along with his governmental colleagues and the other authorities of the Colombian state, for example, the legislature, they have now taken very significant steps to normalize relations with Venezuela. Another step was announced last week. At the beginning of this week, I think it was announced that Colombia would open four or five new consulates in Venezuela to attend to the needs of Colombian nationals in Venezuela. And over the last couple of months, the respective legislatures of Colombia and Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela have held meetings to develop their institutional relationship. There have been meetings along the different points along the Colombian-Venezuelan frontier, especially the main bridges leading from between the two countries, symbolizing the opening up of commercial relations that had been heavily curtailed, if not completely stopped, in previous years as a result of the policies of the previous president, Colombian president Iván Duque. So you've got that going on, which presumably is not entirely to the liking of the United States government.
Right.
But then at the same time, you have Gustavo Petro turning around and condemning Nicaragua's government, the president Daniel Ortega, and calling for Daniel Ortega to be arraigned before the International Criminal Court for the Nicaraguan government's decision to expel 222 people that had been imprisoned in Nicaragua for their terrorist activities and activities financing terrorism that caused such damage to the Nicaraguan economy in 2018.
Which is ridiculous. If you think of all of the things going on in Central and South America and the Caribbean, to single that out as something warranting removing the president, the head of state from office, and referring him for criminal prosecution, it's like, you know, calling for the death penalty for someone with a parking ticket while you're standing next to Al Capone or something.
Right. Yeah, no, very much so. And you see, in Colombia itself has very deep social, it has critical citizen security problems and problems of political violence.
What about Duque and those guys? Send a few of those guys to some court somewhere for all the people they killed and disappeared.
Well, yeah, and under Petro, there have been dozens of people killed so far this year, civilian community leaders and indigenous people's leaders that have been murdered this year. And so he seems to be more concerned about what was essentially a very humanitarian gesture on the part of the Nicaraguan authorities. And because what the people that benefited from the measure of being sent to the United States, those 222 people that had been in jail, if they hadn't been released in that as part of that humanitarian decision, they'd have spent between 15, 20, 25 years more in jail in Nicaragua.
For what they did. So, imagine they, you know, look at the people who occupied the Capitol building in the United States for like, you know, 2 hours or whatever the hell they did. Right. Maybe somebody went to the bathroom in Pelosi's office or something, and they're facing 20, 30 years in prison and stuff for that. These guys, yeah. People died as a consequence of what was done, you know, in Nicaragua that year from their actions.
Yeah, there's a good example of that, Don. In this, there's a guy called Christian. I've forgotten his surname, but he was a notorious gangster, and he was recruited by one of the leaders of the coup, Felix Maradiaga. Felix Maradiaga recruited criminals to occupy one of the main universities in Managua, the Polytechnic University, the so-called Upoli. And they set up a base there from which they sent out their gangs every night to maraud and attack and cause terror among the population of Managua. And there's one very, the most notorious incident that those gangs carried out was the attempted murder of a student leader called Leonel Morales, who'd initially supported the protests around April the 18th, April the 19th of 2018. But he quickly realized that it was all, and in fact, a very well-organized attempted coup, and he changed his mind. And because he changed his mind and was persuading, because he was a national student leader, he was persuading many other young people to look more closely at what was going on. And he was dragged from his home, kidnapped from his home by this gang at the Upoli, led by this Viper character. The Christians, this guy's name, Christian, his pseudonym is Viper. And he has now been Christian Chamorro, right. So he has now, the president of Chile, Gabriel Boric, has agreed to give Chilean citizenship to this guy who's a murderer, a thief, he's tortured people, he's kidnapped people. That's what the Chilean state has now sunk to. They've sunk to identifying with people deeply involved in organized crime and extremely serious offenses, including murder and torture. When you look at that, you just have to ask. This goes back to what we're talking about at the beginning: the contradictions between some of the policies of these social democrat leaders, like Alberto Fernandez in Argentina, Gustavo Petro in Colombia, Lula da Silva in Brazil, and this Gabriel Boric character, who is currently, unfortunately, the president of Chile. Now. The crimes for which those people were convicted actually created a very serious socioeconomic crisis in Nicaragua. It set the Nicaraguan economy back by about 3 years in terms of total losses. They caused huge damage to public property and private property. The damage was estimated at well over $400 million.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of people lost their jobs as a result of the economic crisis that was caused by the failed coup attempt. But all of that just gets treated as if it doesn't matter. It's like it never happened. Do you remember that remark by Harold Pinter, the British dramatist, in his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, where he talks about the way in which the terrorism promoted by the United States against countries like Nicaragua, Mozambique, Angola back then in the 80s, that has never stopped. The United States has continued its terrorist activities right up to this day. But Pinter made the remark that because it's managed so carefully by the Western media, it's as if these terrible events never happened, even as they were happening.
That was journalist Stephen Sefton speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of the show. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.